What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Halper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Halper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary feature film, and more. We have a great show for you tonight. First, I talked to anti-war former Marine and current Green Party candidate for Senate in North Carolina, Brian McGinnis. He had his hand broken while speaking out against the Iran war at a Senate hearing. Then I speak to David Alvarez, the second secretary at the Cuban embassy to the U.S. in Washington, D.C., and Danny Valdez, a New York City-based Cuban-American organizer with DSA, who I will be seeing soon in Havana. More about that shortly. As always, please do like the stream. It's a great way to get more people to hear these important voices and important stories that corporate media either ignores or distorts. So just give it a thumbs up. Also, please subscribe to the channel because we've been doing these amazing additional live streams, which you do not want to miss. They're during the daytime usually. So this past week, for example, we had on Dr. Mohammed Mirandi, who joined us live from Tehran. We also had the excellent Beirut-based journalist Sharmeen Narwani, who is the editor of the excellent news site, The Cradle. And of course, become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. For just $5 a month, you get weekly bonus content, exclusive interviews, extended interviews, early access behind the scenes. So for instance, if you are Patreon supporters at the $5 a month level, you get the full interview we did with Sharmeen, where she says some really spicy stuff that we didn't feel like we could put on YouTube. We also get a full interview that we did with Haim Brashit Zabner, who is a former Israeli military analyst, and so much more. And if you can't swing the $5 a month, then you can become Patreon supporters at $1 a month. And that way you just know that you make this show happen, because we literally couldn't do the Katie Halper Show without your help. Okay, so without any further ado, here is my interview with Brian McGinnis, but don't go away after, because we have another interview right after that. We are so excited to be speaking to Brian McGinnis, who served as a sergeant in the United States Marine Corps from 2000 to 2004. In 2002, he was stationed at Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune in Jacksonville, North Carolina. He was on the all-Marine boxing team and deployed to Iraq as a light armored vehicle crewman in 2003. He was part of Operation Iraqi Freedom from February 2003 to June 2003. And in 2024, he joined the Freedom Flotilla Coalition, attempting to bring aid to Palestine by boat during the Gaza genocide. He is the Green Party candidate for the 2026 United States election in North Carolina. So welcome to the show, Brian. Hi, Brian. How are you?
Hi, doing well, Katie. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining. You made headlines, or you should have made more headlines, but because of our corporate media, you made, I would say, kind of independent alternative media headlines a couple days ago. You very bravely, it was March 4th, you dressed in your Marine Corps uniform, interrupted a Senate Armed Service subcommittee meeting on readiness and management support. And it was on the war in Iran. And you shouted, America does not want to send its sons and daughters to war for Israel. No one wants to fight for Israel. And then you were forcibly removed by United States Capitol Police with the support of U.S. Senator Tim Sheehy, who's a Republican from Montana. And your arm was broken, and you can actually hear it. You can hear the crack. So we're going to play that video, and then we're going to talk about what happened to you right after that.
Out! No one wants to fight for Israel!
His hand!
Oh, my
God.
Let go of the door.
The senator broke his hand. A sitting U.S. senator just broke the hand of a Marine.
Sir, control your Senate!
A U.S. senator just broke the hand of a Marine!
Hand stuck.
A U.S. senator just broke the hand of a Marine!
You're a coward.
Go fuck yourself. That's why you got kicked out, fat ass.
And I think, by the way, we just heard Anthony Aguilar, the great Anthony Aguilar, friend of the show, to the senator, you were a shitty SEAL. That's why you got kicked out, fat ass.
Yes, so let's keep playing this.
Yeah.
Everybody sit down, please.
Is your hand okay?
No,
it's not.
This is disgusting. Disgusting.
Just pull it
this
out.
Now, who was that who said, I'm getting out of here? This was obviously incredibly disturbing. I mean, I had to watch this to prepare. I watched it when it happened. And each time I kind of found myself wincing. Who is the person who starts crying and says, I'm getting out of here?
That's Josephine Gilbo, retired Army intelligence officer of 17 years.
Wow. So she's seen stuff.
Yeah. You know, she's seen stuff. She's read stuff.
But she still was disturbed by that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So describe what happened. What made you do that? What you expected would happen? What wound up happening?
I'm up to here with just the injustice with our military, our American government having a foreign policy of raw military power instead of international law, human rights, or diplomacy. We are just throwing our weight around too much, and I fear this. Braggadocious administration right now has gotten themselves in too deep, and we are not doing well. I think Iran is established and we are in trouble. And I had to speak out because now we're about to deploy, we are threatening to deploy ground troops. My nephew, who is a Marine, has shared with me that guys, you know, see this as a death wish, as a meat grinder. And I myself, as a veteran, with 25 years removed, plus with a family, there's so much more to life. And these young men and women who are going into the forces are there to serve their country valiantly and bravely. But for what? For a bunch of white-collared, distance-rich folks who just are circulating money in their own little relationships. And so that's why I had to stand up. We have to stand against this injustice. It's not only sad to see men and women go die in war for a valiant cause, but for it to be such a so worthless cause, such a selfish cause by these people who have no skin in the game.
Yeah, it's really repulsive. So I just want to show what this senator who claims to be helping de-escalate, what he wrote. This is Tim Sheehy. Capitol Police were attempting to remove an unhinged protester from the armed services hearing. He was fighting back. I decided to help out and de-escalate the situation. This gentleman came to the Capitol looking for a confrontation, and he got one. I hope he gets the help he needs without causing further violence. Now, he's quote tweeting Someone, Alan Ha, who tweeted out, Senator Sheehy joined Capitol Police in lifting up and ejecting anti-war protester Brian McGinnis from an SASC subcommittee hearing. McGinnis is a Green Party candidate running for Senate in North Carolina, and anti-war activists filmed the video below. Now, there is a great community note that says, the senator describes this as, quote, de-escalation, end quote, but full video reporting show he joined officers by physically grabbing the Marine's leg, then his arm breaks. Reports say the protester was treated for an injury after. The Marine did not come to start a confrontation. He protested. So what do you have to say about the senator's representation of what happened?
I think the videos speak for themselves. I don't appreciate his sentiments. Myself has been, I've been in lots of altercations, and I'm Marine. I think I'm hardened, and I want to be galvanized with the Marine Corps boot camp and experience. And I've tried to live that way and be, I'm a fireman, and we, you know, steel sharpens steel. We try to be strong and hold each other up. And so have this senator who's received $600,000+ from AIPAC and is, you know, living a different life. And he's a former Navy SEAL, I understand. But either way, his sentiments to me on a Fox report saying, I hope he gets the help he needs was pretty disrespectful. So yeah, I don't respect anything he's done. And I don't, and the hardship he's put on my wife through all this, that really stings. So I don't really appreciate that. So yeah, I don't appreciate his disingenuous comments, his actions, or any of that.
Yeah, it was pretty transparent that that's not what he was doing, that he was not de-escalating. It seemed like really pathetic, macho, like machismo that actually comes from insecurity. You know, he just like wants to get in on it. He just winds up looking like a coward. Like, you know, it'd be one thing, I would have opposed what he had done, but it would have been one thing if he went up there alone to try to kick you out. I would have opposed that. But watching him try to kind of claim credit after, like, how many, there were already four grown men trying to get you out. And he kind of comes in and tries to join in on it. Like he's a big tough guy. It was really pathetic. It was also, I'm just really sorry this happened to you. I mean, what did you expect would happen?
I just wanted to speak my First Amendment right. I was only focused on getting my message out for the troops, for my fellow veterans and soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines, to just save them from this senseless, unprovoked war.
Yeah, but I mean, and we've seen people get kicked out and people have been rough with them, but I mean, this, I don't have high hopes for the way our government behaves or the way the Capitol Police behave. But I didn't expect someone's hand to get broken.
Me neither. I had no expectations for any of that to happen.
Yeah. And it's funny because these are people who obviously claim to really take service seriously and have nothing but respect for the armed services. And then they literally break your hand, as you are not hurting anyone. You're unarmed. You were not physically confronting anyone. You were just, as you said, and as is clear in that video, you were exercising your First Amendment right. You were speaking out. You were being disruptive. None of that is life-threatening or requires incapacitating someone.
Yeah, a friend pointed out to me I had my gloves and my hat in my hands for most of the altercation, or the them aggressively trying to make me leave. So I wasn't trying to assault. I didn't assault anybody.
Yeah, of course not. Yeah. Yeah. We actually have another angle that I wanted to show, because this shows what happened to you right afterwards. This shows both before and after what happens.
Israel is the reason for this war. America does not want to fight this war for Israel.
Let's go. Come on. Let's go.
America does not want to send its sons and daughters to war for Israel. Your inability to name that shows your ineptness as leaders.
Out.
This is wrong.
Stop.
And nobody wants to fight for Israel.
I mean, also, I just want to point out, we can see from this angle, you were not fighting back. Oh, hi.
Hello.
Not now, buddy.
We can bring on later if you want.
Come on. Yeah. Sorry about that.
a reminder to all our
Commandant, please stand up as a Marine and stand up for America.
And there's the cowardly word I don't like to use, and I'm not going to say it on this video, but I did tweet it out, and I don't like to use it, but sometimes there's no other word for it.
No one wants to fight for Israel!
You can hear it better on this version, yeah.
Sir, thank you for your service.
He's a Marine. Somebody come help him.
Control your Senate committee.
Look at you guys.
Does he say control your Senate committee? That's an activist, right? Supporter of yours, right?
Yeah, that's okay. Tony Aguilar.
Oh, okay. Got it. Oh, so yeah.
He's looking out for me. He's my
great
dog, man. He's helping me out.
And he's a whistle. He blew the whistle on the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or yes, as Aaron Maté likes to call it, the Gaza Holocaust Foundation, basically luring Palestinians to their deaths. And he witnessed a little child who was shot to death. And he was obviously traumatized by this. And he spoke out. And now he's also running for office as a Green Party, with the Green Party. Yes. So shout out to Anthony.
Sure, and his son's that same age, so it just resonates so hard with him.
Right. His son's the same age as Amir, that child, right? He saw killed.
You won't even look back. Look at you guys. You're like robots. Oh my God, what is happening?
That is also very scary, watching people not even turn around as you were just escorted out and had your hand broken.
And you're not even looking back, any of you four-star generals. Oh my God, what is happening right now? Eyes front, robots. Shame.
Realm to deal with.
Oh my God, you guys. What did I just see? I'm getting out of here.
That's fine. Everybody sit down, please.
Oh my God, what is happening?
That's all. Okay, good. No, it's not.
Oh my God.
Stuck. It's disgusting.
Systemic separation.
Oh my God, you guys.
Workers.
Sorry, does that hurt? Can you open it up a little bit just to like change the gap?
Now they're trying to open the door, right?
Clear the hallways.
Out. Yeah, trying to figure out a way.
Clear the hallways.
My hand was really.
Clear the hallways, please.
Can you help him, please?
Yes. Yes. Please
through
the hallways.
What happened? Oh my God! What happened?
That's Medea Benjamin, who's like a total hero. In fact, we're going to Cuba with her this week. But there she is saying what happened, because again, this is a woman who also protests frequently, has gotten arrested. We've seen her kind of like mauled in disgusting ways. But you can see that she is visibly disturbed and surprised when she learns what happened to you.
He got totally smashed. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Why are you getting arrested?
From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, Palestine will be free.
And what about this war in Iran?
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Ah, fuck, my arm is fucking broke.
What are you going to do to him?
My left arm is broke. I understand. Don't fight.
Oh my God. Oh, you guys, come on.
I need you to move.
You need to stop.
Okay.
Brian, stop.
He's fighting for you, not for him.
That's my friend Mark.
He broke his arm.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. He's totally broken.
Oh man.
Please, can you get him some kind of medical attention?
Yes, we are.
Oh my God.
You are? It's great.
Like, what? Were they afraid you were going to like hit them? They had to be touching your arm. They had broken your hand at this point. You had not assaulted, or you had not even tried to assault anyone. The only thing you did was try to stand still so you could finish what you were saying.
Yeah. They just kept on. Every time I'd speak up, they would get extra aggressive.
Please put back. Keep this walkway open.
He broke his arm.
Okay. Would y'all just move aside then? That way people can still exit.
Chelsea, what happened?
We just witnessed a Marine veteran interrupting the hearing, and they broke his arm.
Why did he interrupt the hearing?
Because there is a war in Iran, and our military brothers and sisters are going to die for Israel, and we are here to say no. We do not support Israel. We do not want to die for Israel. Stop the war in Iran right now.
And what did they do to him?
They pulled him out, got his arm trapped in a door, broke his arm, tackled him to the ground. It was a very, very intense situation.
Okay, so obviously you can hear how disturbed she is. So then what happened to you after this point?
They took me to their... where the trucks can deliver things. And that I was taken to the hospital, George Washington University Hospital, by DC Fire, safe and professionally. And then it was nice to meet some firemen because I'm a firefighter in Raleigh, North Carolina. The court date on April 2nd. And I have a good public defender, Celeno. And so we're very thankful for his assistance here. And we are confident to have him defend us.
That's just insane. So the criminals are the ones sending people to not just be killed. I mean, we have to remember they're getting killed. And of course, they're killing civilians. And the people who get in trouble are the ones who try to stop these crimes from happening. It's so inverted.
You're 100% right. It's so sad. It's so hard to exist in this reality. You see me smiling. I'm just trying to be polite because that's what we think we should do. And then people get so butthurt when I act aggressive, and it's hard to not be bipolar in this world. Like, you want to be good, but then you see the reality for what it is and can't help but be natural and react. So
right.
And have emotion.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even think you came off as to me, you came off as outraged. But you weren't, I don't even know if aggressive is the right term, because you weren't hurting anyone. You were just speaking your mind. And, you know, you should be upset. You should be angry because this is infuriating. And in fact, to not be angry about what is happening right now is to be immoral. I think be on the wrong side. So wanted to ask you how you came to be the person you are today, kind of ideologically, politically. You were in the military. I understand your father was also in the military, and now you're obviously someone who's very critical of the military. So what changed your mind? When I say critical of the military, I don't mean you're critical of the people serving. I mean, you were critical of the military sending people to their deaths to fight and kill in unjust wars.
Yeah. I just woken up, when I was in the service, I was ready and willing and able to carry out my orders. And that's all my mind was computing. After the Marines, it is very difficult for soldiers, Marines, sailors, and airmen to assimilate back into civilian life after being so indoctrinated with the military type of life. It's a very different type of life. It's very structured. You speak a different way. It's not a lot of joking or side conversation. It's direct and to the point. So there's a bit of loosening up that one may have to go through, and you might not completely loosen up. And either way, the transition to civilian life is a long and arduous road for many, and many end up committing suicide. Sadly, this is a harsh reality, and that's another aspect of this conversation that has to be addressed. And so, anyway, my transformation from being a Marine and taking orders and not thinking much to finding myself in the world. And I'll mention this, I got hired by the fire department. I went to college for about 3 or 4 years, and it wasn't for me. And so then I joined the fire department. I got hired by the fire department. So glad. And the fire department became my family. And I moved from Illinois back to Raleigh, North Carolina. No family. Just me and those guys. I relied heavily on them for my social strength, or for my familial types of bonds. They were there for me, and I relied on them heavily. And they are some smart aleck, wisecracking dudes. I mean, and so much more so much more smart and than Marines. In the Marines, we were just a bunch of jarheads, just go, go, go. In the fire department, man, they've got time to craft the most devious little plans and tricks on you. And it really taught me another level of humor and wit and friendship. And so anyway, all this just helped unwind me and unwinds us as we grow and learn about the life. And then I ran into my wife and fell in love with her. And she happens to be American Palestinian. And so then learning about her culture and her, where she comes from, where her family has been dealing with, brought it home to and helped me see oppression from that side of the story. In the Marines, we went to Iraq and I oppressed and occupied the Iraqis through my order taking. Then I fell in love with my American Palestinian wife who has been under oppression and her family for decades. And so this kind of gave me a full circle understanding of what our military and what we are funding by funding Israel and what we're all about. And it gave me a full perspective about all that. And so that's how I've come to this point of now wanting to rebuke what our military is doing, what our foreign policy is enacting across the globe and saying enough is enough. We can't be this way anymore. We have to embrace international law, human rights, and diplomacy.
Yeah, amen to that. And what have you learned through your wife? I mean, what happened to her family?
Well, here's the story that really just grinded my gears. My mother-in-law, my wife's mom, she's so sweet. She's so special, so loyal. Whenever a family member is on their deathbed, she goes and she lays with them, whether it's 2 days or 2 weeks, she's there for them. And she's there for us. She takes care of our kids. She's cooks us delicious meals. She's just a saint. She's a wonderful woman. And when she would go back to try to visit her mother in Palestine, these soldiers would give her the third degree. And they would give her arbitrary time spans with her visa, which is a max of 30 days. They'd reduce it to 3 just to make her have to travel back to Jordan to get another visa to come back, all to just visit her mother. So these small stories show me how it really looks with a heart connection. And then from there, I knew it was real. I broadened my view and saw the even harsher realities and the harsher violence that Israeli military and settlers execute upon Palestinians for completely no reason other than racist and hateful reasons. And so that's how I've come to this point. And now I know many don't have any relations or ties to Palestine like I do, and I can respect that. But now I'm going to please respect my voice trying to make you aware of this reality. I'm not lying about it. I'm just trying to make you aware of what I know, because I am one of many that don't know, and I'm just trying to speak. And that was part of my effort, that all this suffering and frustration to get my message out is part of what fueled me to want to speak out at the hearing as well. It's just that the world is going in a bad direction. I'm not going to stand around and let it happen without saying something.
That's obviously very commendable. I want to ask you to react to some comments that Trump made on Monday during a press conference with the Kennedy Center Board of Trustees about his decision to attack Iran. So let's play this and then let me know what your thoughts are.
We don't need oil. We have all the oil we need for ourselves. It's one of the great assets that we have. We have more than double what anybody else in terms of oil production. We're at more than double any other country. So we don't need it, but we did it. It's almost, you could say we did it out of habit, which is not a good thing to do. But we did it because we have some good allies there. We have some great Middle Eastern countries there, Israel there. So we did it for a lot of reasons.
So, okay, he did it out of habit and for Israel. I mean, what can one even say? I mean, what is your response to that?
He's speaking of his resources, of the commodities he cares about as a rich billionaire. And he doesn't care about the peasants, us on the ground, living this life, making this world run. And so he's on a castle on a cloud, speaking about the issues he thinks are real issues to Americans, but they really aren't. we as Americans care about each other and want to just take care of our families, just like everybody else across the globe. And because of his, you know, aspirations of resource allocation, acquisition, he's just thinking that way and disregards our humanity and our care, our livelihoods.
Yeah, it's really disgusting. I mean, it's funny. He's saying the quiet part out loud in some ways. He says, we're doing this out of habit. And he's saying, we're doing this because of Israel. And I actually want to ask you, you said in your protest that this is being done for Israel and you don't want people to die for Israel. So what makes you think that this war is being fought for Israel? And do you think that Trump has other reasons? Trump, the administration, other motivations besides doing it for Israel?
I think it's the military-industrial complex utilizing Israel's already aggressive stance on wanting to create the greater Israel. And they're in cahoots working this plan out. Netanyahu's been to the White House 7 times. That has to mean something. And so the emperor wears no clothes. We see what's happening. The people know what's going on. Epstein files. What's that all about? We know what that's all about. It's bribery at the top scale of the billionaire class, the Epstein class, and it's all, the gig is up. We see it for what it is, and as much as they try to talk like it doesn't exist, we know it does. And so we have to organize, and we have to find a way to hold them accountable. Accountability, that's the word of the year. We need accountability.
Yeah. Now, you, as someone who served in Iraq, you used a different verb. You harmed the people of Iraq. I can't remember. Earlier in this interview, you said something and you framed it negatively. So
occupation.
You were part of the occupation. What are the similarities and differences, as far as you can see, between the war in Iran right now and that of the lead up and military operation you were part of in Iraq?
Hard to answer, Katie, because I was in a bubble. I was in the Marines, and we heard murmurs of going to Iraq. And we just wait with bated breath to hear when we go. And we're concerned about our girlfriends and our mothers and our families and how we're going to, when we're going to say goodbye, when we're going to have our last Whopper, or pizza. That's the mindset of a young Marine, soldier, sailor, airman. Now, we as the adults in the room have to speak up because we can contextualize the issues going on, what strings are being pulled and why we're doing this. And so comparing my experience or perspective of Iraq, I've got a perspective now that, and everybody does. Trump himself said it was a waste of, it was a senseless war. There were no WMDs. It was a waste of billions of dollars. ISIS gave birth to ISIS. The whole region is destabilized. So that was false. And so we can use that to see that will probably be what will happen with Iran. Scarily, Iran is much larger than Iraq, much more reinforced. They've been prepared for this. They've seen this coming for a long time. You know, regardless of what the Western media says and what Trump acts like, he says, things aren't looking good for America and Israel. America needs to either leave this altercation or I'm afraid they're going to resort to escalating this war. And that escalation is serious. If they go to nuclear war, then nuclear winter is coming, and that will kill millions and millions of people. And if that can't get us off our butts and protest, then I don't know what else is will.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. So do you believe that we're going to see a ground invasion of Iran? And what do you predict will happen?
They are talking about taking on some island off the shore of Iran as a stronghold position or something. Again, my nephews in the Marines, they were talking about Iran could be a meat grinder. I think Iran has shown abilities to defend itself very well. And so I'm fearful for that. And sadly, I think another reason why they want to execute ground on the troops type of mission so that they can launder the true American death toll that has already happened. This is just my speculation, but I don't think 25 is a number. I think more than that have died. And so they want to somehow continue this attack and aggression to then dilute the stories of how we've come to a death toll that's much larger than 25, which I think they're deceitfully lying to us about.
Right. So what made you decide to run with the Green Party? What are the stances of the Green Party on the war on Iran? And who are you running against?
I'm running for the Green Party because I've been driven to this realm of affecting change through a hopeless position of just watching the genocide for the last 2.5 years. I'm desperate to do anything I can to cause change legally and efficiently. And so that's what brought me to politics. Nobody wants, I mean, politicians have such a bad reputation but I've learned a lot through this and I'm very excited to take this on now. So that's what spurred me on. And the Green Party was the fit for me because they're the people you want to hang out with at a party. They're the people that are for the people, planet, peace over profit. We are not bought. We do not take corporate donations, or we don't deal with PACs or super PACs. And that's the party for me. And I think that's the party everybody needs to learn about and you'll get along with and find that we are there for the people. We are for the people. I'm running against Mike Watley from the Republican Party and Roy Cooper from the Democratic Party. And they're both feckless leaders. Mike Watley will be Trump's lapdog and do whatever he says, and you'll get more of the same stuff that you know would get from MAGA. And then Roy Cooper is showing a lot of, he's not listening to his people. The Democrats have presented resolution number one, which would stop arming Israel. And you know, he and Josh Stein, the governor of North Carolina, want to reject that resolution. So right there, they're not listening to their constituents. So I think the world is hungry for a third party or another option. And the Green Party is established. We've been around for a while. We know what we stand for. And we're here for you. And we're here to represent the people.
So if you were elected senator, how would you handle the situation we're seeing right now?
I would vote for the wars, yes, to the wars resolution so we could have more checks and balances. I would vote against any more aggressions from the American military. I would vote in a peaceful way. And just to simply put it, I would prioritize people and planet and peace over profit. We can't be bought. So I'm going to vote with the people's, you know, well-being in mind, in our budget in mind. Over $1 trillion is spent on our military budget, and that's half our congressional budget. Think of all the things we could do with a fraction of that for our schools, for our childcare, for our education, for our affordable housing. So that's what I would bring to our Congress, to our Senate.
Did you have any aha moments that really changed your view of the world besides what you've already talked about?
Well, you know, when I really had my downward spiral with the Gaza genocide, before it really ramped up, was when Tom Tillis sent out emails bullet pointing the fake atrocities that happened in October 7th, highlighting the beheaded babies, 40 beheaded babies. Doesn't that just sound suspicious? So he parroted that. And as knowing the American people and how people are just going to see this, 40 beheaded babies, Hamas, oh my God. And they would just say, I hate these people. These people need to die. And they make up their mind right away. And as soon as they make up their mind, they'll just hold on to that for the rest of their life. They would never give any more critical thinking. Right. The work has already been done to make Islam and Muslims the villain, which is so untrue and so wrong. And it's such a shallow, uncritical viewpoint and such a racist viewpoint. And it's despicable to know so many fall victim to these propaganda and lies.
Right. It's atrocity propaganda. So it like bypasses the brain and it just goes to people's like stomachs basically, and they feel repulsed. And then they believe these lies about mass rape, beheaded babies, all of which have been debunked. And in fact, very recently, the Israeli government cleared the actual rapists, the Israeli rapists who were documented on video raping a Palestinian detainee. So you really can't make this up. As I say, every accusation is a confession. But I think that's exactly what happens. I mean, that's why they said that Saddam Hussein was removing babies from incubators in Kuwait, right? They want to say something that makes people horrified and wants and makes people see the other as monsters. And then they are okay with the fact that they are the ones actually getting raped, getting beheaded because they are monsters. So yeah, that was a very formative moment, I think, for a lot of people. So I wanted to ask you to respond to some audio of Trump. Here he is being asked about the fallen troops. So let's hear him in his own words.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
What do you want to see in the deal? Because earlier you said reportedly that the deal wasn't good enough.
There will be no nuclear weapons. That's where it starts. And then on top of that, there's plenty of things that we're going to get. Thank you very much.
Do you have a comment on the six service members who passed?
What do you want to see in the deal? Because earlier you said reportedly that.
So he's asked, do you have a comment? Sorry. Do you have a comment on the servicemen who passed? And he basically ignores the question.
Yeah, I mean, he's just playing this like a game, and then just was trying to avoid responsibility and accountability, and doesn't want to have any bad media related to him. And that's really. We need leaders who will take responsibility, and he's unable to do that. And I hope people can see that and make correct judgment that he is no man to be leading this country. He has no integrity, no character, and I hope a lot of his MAGA people will wake up to that and lose their loyalty. That unquestioning loyalty is ridiculous.
And I'm sure your enemies and your haters are going to say, how could you possibly vote for this guy? What experience does he have? He's never run for office before. He's never been an elected official before. What is your response to that?
Well, that's not a bad sign. I'm not an embedded politician. I don't have a lot of connections and people that are shaking my hand under the table and winking at me. I'm just a man from the ranks of us as United States citizens. I'm a father of four. I'm a Marine veteran, I'm a firefighter, and I'm a public servant. I aim to be a public servant. I am all about some term limits. I don't want to be a career politician. I want to step up. I want to make a difference. I want to help the world that I see falling apart in front of my eyes, and that's why I'm here. So I hope that people can believe me, and that's my genuine statement, and that's why I'm here, and that's it.
Thank you so much, Brian McGinnis. Great to hear from you.
Thank you so much for speaking out
and your bravery.
Thank you.
That was so interesting. What a fascinating guy. What an insane story. Don't go anywhere, though, guys, because we have another amazing interview. But before I bring on our next two guests, please do remember, if you haven't already, to like the stream. Please subscribe so you don't miss any of these great additional interviews that we've been doing. So you press subscribe and then the bell. And please become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, it's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Very excited to bring on our next two guests. David Alvarez is the second secretary at the Cuban Embassy to the U.S. in Washington, D.C. And Danny Valdez is a New York City-based Cuban-American organizer with DSA, who I'll be seeing very soon in Havana, because we are both part of the Nuestra America convoy that is bringing humanitarian aid and solidarity to the people of Cuba. We are going with Code Pink and Progressive International. Those are two of the major organizers of this convoy. Danny is organizing a Cuban-American delegation, and I will be part of the media delegation. And we will put YouTube links, and we will put links to this in the YouTube description. Without any further ado, here is David Alvarez, the second secretary of the Cuban embassy to the U.S. in Washington, D.C., and Danny Valdez, a New York City-based Cuban-American organizer. Danny, welcome back to the show. And David, welcome to the show for the first time. Thank you guys so much for joining.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
Thank you so much.
So I want to start off, first of all, by asking you to explain, David, what it is that you do, especially because the diplomatic situation between Cuba and the United States is atypical. So what is your job? What are the parameters? We can start there.
Yes, the diplomats here at the Embassy of Cuba in Washington, D.C., we basically have to wear different hats because it's a small embassy. And we try to, be as more as proactive as we can be. So we basically have, we deal with different sectors, right, of society of the United States. So I'm second secretary at the Embassy of Cuba, and I work specifically with the cultural sector, but I also work with what you might call political forces in the United States. That's basically civil society, parties, movements, organizations. So yeah, that's basically it. I also try to work with local elected officials and with also Congress.
So the big news right now, of course, is that there was a major development in Cuba, which is that the electrical grid has collapsed. That's how some places are describing it. Let's show a news story on this, and then I will have both of you react to the news.
And breaking news into CNN, Cuba's electrical grid has suffered a complete and total collapse. This is according to the country's power operator. It's the first nationwide blackout since the U.S. effectively shut off the flow of oil to Cuba.
So what is your guys' reaction to that news?
Well, yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm not sure if this is the first time that there has been a national collapse of the electric grid since the Trump administration enforced the total blockade against our country, oil blockade against our country, that we actually experienced something similar a little bit more than a week ago. And it basically did not make the headlines here, but this time it did. This time around, we are much more prepared to get our national electric grid back on track. And we're already, we're seeing news on Cuban news that it's already, getting stabilized again. So this obviously is a result of a direct effect of the U.S. Oil blockade against our country. Effectively, we have not received fuel from any country since December. So can you imagine a society working without fuel for more than 3 months?
Yeah,
and I would add that, what we're seeing now is the culmination of a 6-decade-long campaign that has been waged by the United States to, oftentimes it has also been militarily, but to intervene economically in Cuba and really like freeze the development of Cuba. That has been one of the sort of main charges that the U.S. State Department has really carried forward. And this is just, it's that taken to its logical maximum. They call it a maximum pressure campaign, but it really is a maximum suffering campaign. Right. That is the intention here. And we're seeing it, I want to also say that, this is not as simple as the lights don't turn on for a few hours and then you just kind of move on, right? Like, this is a nationwide collapse of the power grid, which means it affects hospitals and schools and traffic lights and public transportation. It's very easy for us to kind of take for granted how much electricity plays a part in literally everything we do, from like cooking a meal all the way up to getting a surgery, right? And none of that is possible when not only when you have a nationwide blackout, but also if even just having an unreliable electricity day to day really makes a lot of the functioning of a country kind of impossible. And that is what Cuba has been experiencing more acutely than ever over the last 3 months. But you know, it's kind of been the story of the last six decades in Cuba as well.
Right.
Yes. I just wanted to add, you know, to what Danny was saying, that what our relatives are going through, our families are going through, is that our society as a whole has had to reaccommodate their lives to this new reality, where you have to wake up in the morning and the first thing that you do is, you know, cook all the meals of the day, because it's the only moment that you have electricity, and that you have to seize the moment and cook everything, and then, you know, store it in a fridge, and then have a massive blackout that you're not expecting, and then trying to think how you can keep the food preserved on the fridge for many long hours. It's a very difficult way of living, and it changes your life dynamics. You cannot go to work on a normal basis because there is almost zero public transportation. You cannot basically get, you know, the goods that you want to get for your sustainability, because it's hard to go outside and see and find where you can buy, you know, basic goods, because the whole society has had to change in less than 3 months, reaccommodate themselves in a new normality, which is basically the result of a collective punishment. We have to be very clear about this. This is collective punishment and an act, a genocidal act by the United States government against the people of Cuba. We might not be seeing bombs being dropped against our country, but our people is suffering because of this, you know, strangulation, asphyxiation of our economy, of our people, of our way of living. So it's something that is actually really serious, and unfortunately mainstream media covers it very, you know, very lightly, you know. The US is ramping up its pressure campaign, ramping up the pressure. No, it's collective punishment. We have to be clear about this. It's collective punishment and an act of genocide against a society, against a people that is suffering these actions.
You know, I just want to ask you before moving on to discussing the kind of ramifications of this more, the causes. You mentioned genocide, and I think not a lot of people know who aren't already interested in Cuba how uniquely internationalist and solidaristic Cuba is throughout history, or throughout, I guess, the history since Fidel Castro's arrival to power. And, you know, you mentioned genocide. Cuba is very committed to Palestinian liberation. They fought on the side of they fought against apartheid. Leaders of South Africa and Palestinian leaders have always expressed a lot of gratitude towards Cuba. Tons of countries receive Cuban doctors, although those, of course, under American bullying, basically, are being are now leaving. Can you talk a little bit about this history of internationalism that Cuba participates in?
Yes. Cuba, I mean, it's the essence of how we develop as a society. I mean, if you do not practice international solidarity and solidarity with your own people, you do not function as an actual socialist society. That is how we see it. And that's how we have acted throughout the years. We have changed our efforts. We have had we participated in the liberation efforts, the independence efforts against colonialism in Africa, and moving forward a little bit, a few years, we have participated in humanitarian efforts with medical brigades throughout the entire world, to be honest, and that is why we have the highest amount of doctors per capita in the world. And that is why we try to travel around the world and help people however we can. This is the essence of our being. Regarding the Palestinian people, you probably know that we have more than 200 scholarships for students that come from Gaza so that they can learn how to study medicine at the, we call it ELAM, Latin American School of Medicine, and they can give back to their people once they come back to the country. And I mean, we have always practiced solidarity with the people of Gaza, of Palestine, and we are in every forum, international forum that we can be at, supporting our brothers and sisters from these horrible genocidal actions that they're suffering from.
What do you think about the way that the CNN just described the collapse of the grid? It makes it seem almost kind of coincidental that it happened under this blockade. It reminds me of the passive voice that we see used, you know, how like Palestinians die, Israelis are killed. What are your thoughts on this framing?
No, I think you're 100% right that it follows a very eerie pattern that we see whenever, you know, the U.S. is involved in, you know, something awful. The media does the work of sort of trying to soften it or trying to sort of, you know, again, like passive voice their way around what's going on. But I think what's heartening about this moment is I can tell you as somebody who spent the better part of a decade organizing around international issues that the veil is off right now in a way that really has never been before. A lot of the work I used to have to do was like getting past the sort of liberation, rah, 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 like why we're doing this, so that try to connect with people about why it's actually happening. But they're not even bothering to put up pretenses about this stuff anymore. They're just kind of acting completely unilaterally. And, you know, this is the least, like the war with Iran is the least popular war ever. Is that causing them to sort of slow down in the slightest? Like, no, not really. And I think the Israel Gaza sort of like moment that happened in American culture that was led by young Jews, that was led by young Palestinians, people who are at the forefront of what was happening. You know, I'm personally hopeful that Cuban Americans, younger Cuban Americans like me and, you know, people younger than me are sort of coming to that same moment where they're realizing like, hey, all of this, the entire narrative I learned growing up about what Cuba is and how it functions and all of that stuff, like a lot of that was just straight up wrong. And what does that mean in terms of how the U.S. is complicit in the conditions that it then turns around and condemns? So there's a very similar moment happening right now with Cuban Americans, and I'm hopeful that that can sort of continue to grow momentum, because I think it was a really important part of how we talk about Israel sort of changed over the last few years, including in the media.
Yeah, that Israel doesn't get to claim that it represents all Jews, and like the Miami contingency, the Miami contingent doesn't get to claim that it represents all Cuban Americans.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And of course, then there's the question of sadism, which we're seeing. I mean, there's definitely the parallel between the Israel thing and the Cuba thing, where you have a huge, powerful, well-funded, well-connected lobby that claims to speak for all people in diaspora in the case of Cuba, and not, I wouldn't call it, diaspora as in like way, 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 way long ago in the case of Israel, but let's just say Jews. But then there's also a lot of parallels, I think, between what we see in Cuba and what we see in Iran, right? Where you have the Cuban diaspora, the Iranian diaspora, and you have really a quite aggressive, I would say disgusting kind of framing and behavior on the part of whether it's monarchists of Iranian descent or I don't know what you call them. I don't want to use that word. I don't want to get in trouble, but people who are very anti-Cuban government and the Cuban descent in the Cuban diaspora, excuse me. Or dissent, as in dissent, but
we call them anti-Cuban.
Okay, good, Cuban. That's anti-Cuban. Yeah, but you know, you do see, and they claim to speak for all of them, right? So, yes. I mean, even this is another story. I have to do something on this, but there was an Iranian Canadian guy who was killed by people, and all of the media was presenting it like he was killed by regime supporters, Iranian regime supporters. He was actually suing like Reza Pahlavi. That's a whole other story, but you never know that the people who actually killed him were supporters of Pahlavi, not of the quote unquote regime. But I wanted to actually ask you about that. Yeah, you about this piece that you wrote, Danny, for The Guardian. I'm Cuban American. For the sake of both countries, Trump's siege must end. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, crushes our people and calls it freedom. We want engagement, not escalation. So what are the ways that this benefits not just the people of Cuba, and we can talk about that more with you, David, but why is this good for Cuban Americans and also, I mean, all Americans? I mean, I just think of the medical stuff. Like we spoke about this with Liz 100%. From Belly of the Beast, how, you know, you have these Republican doctors, like Republican Party doctors from the United States that have to go and get Alzheimer's medication from Cuba because of the sanctions. They're not allowed. It's not allowed to be like accessible without actually like going there or trying to get it. People probably don't know that Cuba like developed a lung cancer vaccine, right? Treatment for amputation. So yeah. So Danny, talk about how this benefits Cuban Americans and then Americans in general, and then also your response to that, David.
Yeah, there's a few angles. Like obviously, many Cuban Americans have family on the island that are suffering, and you would think that that would be enough to get them to not support the actions of the U.S. But for many of these hardliners, they are sort of willing to sacrifice Cuban people if it brings harm to what they call the Cuban regime.
Right.
A very zero sum game for them. And they do not care if something helps the Cuban people, if it also happens to help the Cuban government, you know, stay afloat and run a country. They just oppose it reflexively. Right. And to me, it's disgusting to turn around, no matter how you feel about whatever the Cuban government, the Iranian government. I don't pay taxes to those people.
Right.
I don't pay taxes to Cuba. I pay taxes to the United States government, which is then using those taxes and weaponizing my own identity against the people that, you know, were it not for my grandmother getting on a plane 60 years ago, I would have grown up there too. Right. I'm not that far removed from what's happening on the island. And so to turn around and to call for the mass starvation and immiseration of your homeland. I mean, to me, it's just like beyond the pale in a way I can't even really comprehend. And for it to be not only one of them, right, but every powerful Cuban American in Congress or in office basically is lockstep behind this maximum pressure.
Yeah,
rout out the Cuban government by causing like immiseration line. And you know, like, I do think there is a generational divide in the Cuban American community that is becoming more pronounced. But I think this is kind of the apex of it, right? Because they have the power now. They have the narrative power. They have the actual political power to basically do what they want here. I think it will be very interesting to see, and we're already starting to see some fractures in amongst Cuban Americans with the fact that Trump is talking to the Cubans at all, right? Like to them, even that, sort of outreach or diplomacy and to try to find a diplomatic solution out of this problem is off the table. And that's all that Cuba has asked for 60 years. It's just normal relations like you have with Vietnam and China and all and other communist countries around the world. Why can't we have that same relationship with Cuba? That's it. That was the ask. And to allow Cuba to develop on its own terms and express its sovereignty in whatever way that it wanted, never posing a threat to the United States in any shape, way, or form. So, you know, I really hope that we can carry this message that Cuban Americans are not a monolith. We do not all stand for the starvation of our people, of our homeland. We're not all deranged Trump voters. There's 2.5 million of us in this country. And, you know, the 300,000 or whatever, like right wing Cubans in Miami that really drive this whole thing are actually just a tiny fraction of the Cubans who are living here. And I would bet most of them do not support mass starvation for their friends, family back home.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, that was a wonderful point that you were using, Danny. You know, we've been around here in the United States, and wherever we go, wherever we travel, we meet so many Cubans. I mean, Cubans, Cuban Americans. For us, they're all Cuban, regardless of where they were born. That's to start with. 99.9% of the times, they are friendly. They want to have better relations with Cuba, between Cuba and the United States. They want to engage with their families. They want to trade. They want to invest in their home country. They want to have a normal relationship like every other country has and every other migrant here in the United States has with their home country, with their home nation. The United States holds or is home for the majority of Cuban migrants living outside of Cuba. And what Danny was saying about, you know, not being a monolith, it's totally true. And it's not only totally true, it's based on statistics, on data, on numbers. The last poll that I remember seeing was that about 18% of the Cuban population, the Cuban population represented 18% of the population of Florida. And in as a total, in the United States, it represents about 0.2% of the population. So basically, you would say that in regards to politics, they might be a little bit, you know, significant in places like Miami. But at the same time, Miami is not a hardcore, you know, right-wing state or city. And at the same time, regarding the normalization efforts during Obama, you found out that the rhetoric changed, and the political talk and the political speech in these places changed also. And all of a sudden, Obama was very popular when he changed the policies regarding Cuba, because there is an issue which you cannot ever stop thinking about, is the fact that Cubans are migrants in this country. Most of them are migrants, and most of them don't have a citizenship here. Most of them have a residency, which they get very easily because of something called the Cuban Adjustment Act from the 1960s in comparison to other countries. But still, they are migrants in a country where they have to fit in, where they have to start living in. So, you know, that has a lot of weight when you want to, you know, start your life from scratch, when you want to develop a family, when you want to grow up, grow old in an economy which is different to your nation's society. So basically, they have to fall in line with the narrative where they live. But what Danny was saying is that there is definitely a shift of thought, of political thinking, and it has a lot to do with generations. It's a generational shift.
Yeah, in some ways, actually, I almost feel like the diaspora Iranian population is being helpful, because they are being so over the top and sadistic. Like, it's a little bit harder for people to understand. I mean, and that's one of the reasons I'm glad you guys are on this show, but it's a little bit more abstract. It's like cutting off the oil, sanctions. It's not as immediate. You have to really be taught about how, no, this is a death sentence for people, right? Like, this means they mm-hmm. can't get cancer medication. No, this means they can't go through dialysis. This means they can't do lots of things that are questions of survival and health. But with Iran, it's so direct, because they're literally saying, like, no, we want them to be bombed. Like, listen to Iranians and please bomb that country that we claim to care so much about. Like, we are claiming to speak for the people. But it is, it's a parallel. It's just that in the case of Iran, it's like so explicit, because they're calling for actual bombs as opposed to economic warfare.
I think at the end of the day, like, it is kind of a toxic mix of class grievance.
Yeah.
Like real trauma that people incur from having to leave everything they've ever known behind, and sometimes under what they consider to be like pretty like stressful situations under duress, and just like this echo chamber that just amplifies and regurgitates it all over and over. I cannot tell you, growing up in Miami, it was, and like leaving the bubble in Miami and hearing other people talk about Cuba for the first time, I was shocked, because I had never really heard Cuba talked about in any positive or whatever way at all. So it really is this all-encompassing thing that, you know, is self-perpetuating.
Right.
And, you know, I think as like Cuban Americans, for example, like I'm one generation removed from the trauma, right? But like somebody who's second generation or third generation or fourth generation, you're just able to see it in a way that is maybe more objective. That doesn't mean that these other people's trauma is not something we should talk about whatever. But, you know, like with a little bit of distance from it, you can actually see the situation for what it is pretty clearly. Like, well, it's not complicated.
It's fascinating, because we actually had on the other show that I do, Useful Idiots, that I co-host with Aaron Mate, we had on someone named Behrouz Ghamari, who is an Iranian academic intellectual who was literally on death row in Evin prison. And they let him out because they thought he was going to die of cancer. And then he wound up surviving because he's still alive. But like, it was incredible because this is someone who gets that the regime change efforts are not good. Like, he is so clear eyed, you know, and he's able to see that his trauma that he obviously experienced, because they literally were trying to kill him, he's able to see that that doesn't justify bombs. That doesn't right. justify killing people, because he's a humane person, right? He cares more yeah. about his, and it would honestly be totally relatable to understand someone who is like vindictive and led by grievances when they were trying to kill you. But it's interesting that people who have grievances that are about economics, which really are not quite the same. I mean, I know losing like a plantation or whatever, I'm being a little hyperbolic, but you know what I mean? Like, that's not the same thing as literally being on death row. And of course, there are people who left Cuba who were not that state and in that state of affairs. And of course, the more recent people have left, some of them weren't wealthy at all, you know, and they were escaping basically U.S.
U.S. imposed poverty.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But it is interesting that like why is it that that guy is able to see it? And then you have people who have not been, on death row who aren't able to see it. I wanted to also ask.
It would require shedding their identities.
Right. You know,
that.
Right.
And that is a really difficult thing to ask anybody to do.
Right. Right. Well, it also reminds me of the victimhood identity that so many American Jews have. I mean, even ones who've never experienced anti-Semitism. But again, it's so part of their identity that to look at what Israel is doing and realize that like, oh, this is so clearly a genocide. No, the genocide is not what Hamas tried to do on October 7th. The genocide is what all human rights organizations, including B'Tselem, which I guess is an organization of self-loathing Jews, apparently, know that it's genocide. I mean, it's absurd.
It's so interesting to me, Katie, how similar, how all the overlaps here between everything that we've talked about, because I've been called not a real Cuban. I've been called a self-hating Cuban. It's all the same. They have no ground to stand on, and they know it.
Right.
You know? So the only thing they can turn to is by like smear you.
So I'm a capo. They call me a capo.
A capo.
Whatever. Yeah.
Congratulations.
I know. You get so many trolls and bots that comment on your posts and say, you know, I'm Cuban and you're wrong. And that's their only point.
Exactly.
There's no point behind what they're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Because they're used to taking on someone like me, right? I'm like a secular Jewish New Yorker. It's like, that's one thing, but you guys unfortunately are actually, you know, Cuban. So they don't get to claim to be the only ones. So I wanted to ask you guys about a really disturbing, but so on brand moment of Trump speaking on Monday. I don't even want to say anything. I think I'm just going to play it and ask you guys to respond to it, because it really speaks for itself.
I was just with a fantastic person who's Cuban and made a fortune in sugar, you know, Fun Hull family, right? And this family wants to go back to Cuba to visit it. They haven't been back in like 50 years or something. They largely come from Cuba. And we'll see what happens. They were asking me about that. They want to go back, not only Fun Hull. A lot of Cubans have said, oh boy, would they love to go back. I think Cuba, I don't know, it's in its own way, for tourism and everything else, it's a beautiful island, great weather. They're not in a hurricane zone, which is nice for a change, you know. They won't be asking us for money for hurricanes every week. But I think Cuba's seen the end. You know, all my life I've been hearing about the United States and Cuba. You know, when will the United States do it? I do believe I'll be the honor of having the honor of taking Cuba. That'd be good. That's a big honor.
Taking Cuba
in some form, yeah. Taking Cuba. I mean, whether I free it, take it, I think I could do anything I want with it. You want to know the truth? They're a very weakened nation right now. They were for a long time. Very violent leaders. Castro was a very violent leader. His brother's a very violent leader. Extremely violent. That's how they governed. They governed with violence. But a lot of
people, as opposed to him, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, this is a guy who says like he's literally at war with Iran for fun. He literally said that recently, that it's because it's fun. He said it's because of habit.
I mean, to me, my first thought was, you know, the pedophilia showing through here, because like the way he kind of describes it as like this weird sex object or something, like it really is like thoroughly disgusting in a way, yeah. Even for Trump. I think right. It is like a really gross way of just talking about really anything.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, especially an entire other nation with 11 million lives on it that are, you know, that you are directly causing to harm to, you know, that to me is just so gross. I mean, there's no other word for it. And like him, you know, I think they got high off of Venezuela. And I think that's one of the main reasons why he thought he could do the same thing in Iran. One of the reasons why he thinks he can do the same thing in Cuba. But I think he's going to find, much like he's finding in Iran, that the Cuban revolution is very well entrenched in Cuban society. Right. It's not something you can just kind of like pry out with like tweezers and like replace with something else. There's a lot of social infrastructure that the Cuban government has built over the last 67 years. There are people whose entire, you know, who were lifted out of poverty because they got a set amount of calories every day from the Cuban government, you know? Right. So I don't think it's going to be as easy as they think it is. And they've fallen flat on their face, even in Venezuela. Like, I don't even know what they thought they accomplished there, but I guess they got a pliant sort of state out of it. And maybe that's their goal for Cuba as well, to get a more pliant state. But the thing about Cuba, like I keep saying, is like, Cuba doesn't, it's not really a resource rich place. I mean, he talks about it having great weather. Like, think about what he said about Venezuela, about the oil. We got to get the oil, right? Like, for him, it's like another place to build a Trump hotel or whatever and golf course.
Exactly.
And him and his friends can sort of basically turn back the clock, because that's what Cuba was before the revolution, right? It was basically a client state for the American elite and the American mob. And unfortunately, our union brothers and sisters also partook in that. Yeah. But that's what it was. And and that is what caused the conditions that led to the revolution in the first place. So I think you'll find even the most jaded Cubans about, you know, Cuban socialism out there today would, nobody wants to go back to a situation where they feel like they're just a client state. I mean, just look over to Puerto Rico to get a sense of what that's like, you know. So that's not a viable future for them, for Cubans either. And most Cubans, even the ones that are anti-government or don't like the whatever, they understand that U.S. intervention here is not going to result in anything fruitful.
Yeah, and it's also so humiliating. And David, I want to ask you to respond to that video, but maybe I should actually ask you first to not just respond to that video, but I think it's worth looking at the way a certain Cuban American member of Congress responded to this, because I think then you can kind of respond to it on two levels, unless it's, but I hope you, if you ever take blood pressure medication, you're probably going to want to do that right now. Let's just take a look at this. Congressman Carlos Jimenez writes, response to the video that we just saw of Trump. He writes, "My name is Carlos Jimenez. I am the only member of Congress born in Cuba, and I fully support President Trump's actions against the regime in Havana. It would absolutely be a great honor for the president to take the island and liberate it." So what are your thoughts on this as an actual Cuban? And by the way, he was born in 1954. What are your thoughts? And to see that full interview with Danny and David, please do join us at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. And as always, please do like the stream, give it a thumbs up, and please do subscribe. And we will see you guys next week. Bye, everyone. Thanks again so much for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, where for just $1 a month, you help make this show happen. And for $5 a month, you get great bonus content, including extended interviews, bonus episodes, sneak peeks at my upcoming documentary, and early access interviews. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, and Brad Bloom. Brad Bloom and Andrew Calloway are the audio engineers, and our researcher is Nate Newborn. Our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.